Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Reptile Radio fans, and welcome to the March 16th, 2015 episode of the original herp-oriented airwave sensation on the World Wide Web. The one and only that never leaves you lonely. The sound sensation that's like a 45-minute herp vacation. The indomitable Double R, Reptile Radio. This is your East Coast host, CK, at the Double R Studio, working the industry update that you guys on the Bush League boards have been clamoring for. As today's guest is the in-house counsel for U.S. ARC, and a name everyone in Herp Nation needs to know, Mr. Rick Stanley. Rick is a lifetime herper like so many of you out there, and brings a commitment and passion to protecting herp keepers' rights that only someone who truly understands our collective genetic makeup can. So I'll keep the monologue short and get right to the legal retort. From U.S. ARC headquarters, representing your favorite cold-blooded scales and tails, Mr. Rick Stanley. Hey, Rick, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. How's it going over there?
Well, it's been cold up here, up north here, but now we've got some good stuff going on at U.S. ARC, and I'm excited to discuss it with you.
That's great. And, you know, as is customary on our show, when somebody's on for the first time, and because you're a herper, can you just give us a little background about Rick Stanley, the herper, first, before we get into the meat and potatoes?
Sure. I am the in-house counsel for U.S. ARC. That means that I work with Phil Goss on a daily basis, and then we have our law firm that files lawsuits for us and so on. I've been a lawyer for almost 30 years. I've been the owner of Reptiles and Amphibians, and I can't believe this, but over 50 years.
Wow.
I've had some really cool animals over the years, including venomous snakes and crocodilians. Some people may remember the Mid-Atlantic Reptile Show in Baltimore, Maryland. It was one of the three original, large reptile shows in the United States, and I was one of the original directors and the legal guy for them, so I formed the nonprofit that was used to conduct the show.
Nice.
About 15 years ago, I became involved in reptile legislation and regulations, and have successfully had favorable laws and regulations put in place in Maryland, and likewise successfully opposed unfavorable laws and regulations. Some years ago, I lived in the Everglades for a couple years, and more currently, I possess, the permits that are required to collect pythons in South Florida.
Huh. Okay. Now, I had Mr. Graziani on here, it's probably almost a year ago he was on here, and he said that they're really not even, hardly anybody's even looking for pythons anymore. Apparently they're getting really scarce.
Well, the cold snaps that we've had really knocked the population back, because unlike, the propaganda that USGS puts out there, these animals aren't biologically designed to hibernate, and so they do the opposite of what snakes, that we're more familiar with do. When it gets cold, they'll come back out to sun even when it's really super cold, and that kills off a lot of them, but it hasn't killed them all off.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. That I just find it's so unnerving that they'll say whatever they have to say to push their agenda. whether it's a blatant lie or, you know, or whatever, it doesn't really matter. They'll just keep standing behind it until everybody believes it.
Right. Yeah. It's, yeah. And really, I mean, you know, my observation is that, you know, the Burmese pythons are probably, you know, right on the edge of, you know, the boundary where they can, you know, live. So that, you know, northward movement is, you know, maybe miles. Yeah, but, you know, any significant northward movement seems extraordinarily unlikely.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's been cold. It was cold in Florida this year too.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'm, and in fact, I'm going to be down there very soon, and I'm anticipating that, you know, we'll find the remains of Burmese pythons like they did, you know, a couple years ago.
All right. Sounds interesting. Now, you know, before we get into the national, the Python ban stuff, you recently had a success in West Virginia. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Give people a feeling for, you know, what you've been doing over there in the USARC office.
Sure. Yeah. You know, people in the HERP community who have been following USARC and following the legislative matters are probably aware that, you know, Ohio was, you know, a big state level issue, you know, some years back. And, you know, and now we had West Virginia, where about a year ago, almost to the day, the West Virginia legislature passed a dangerous wild animal law, and that law empowered what they called a dangerous wild animal board to adopt a list of dangerous wild animals. And the simple definition was that these animals, you know, should present serious public health and safety concerns. And the manner that the Dangerous Wild Animal Board would, you know, propose this list was via what they call in West Virginia a legislative regulation, which is a fairly complex process, much more complex than, for example, the legislative process that that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife has used to you know, list the Burmese and more recently you know, the reticulated pythons and other anacondas.
Mm-hmm. So they have their. In other words, it's a similar process, but the way it's carried out is different. In other words, the goal is the same, but the process is different.
Right, right. It's a much more simplistically explaining it at the federal level. That if the authority is given to the Fish and Wildlife, and they promulgate the regulation, and the legislature that no longer really has anything to do with it. Whereas in West Virginia, what they call a legislative rule, the rule has to go through a process where it's reviewed by what they call the Legislative Rule Making Review Committee. And then it has to go entirely through the legislature again to be approved. Let me back up a second and just, you know, I think that one important thing that was, you know, in addition to, you know, having the list being made by an agency, as compared to Ohio, where that was, the list was made legislatively. Another thing that they did in West Virginia that was unusual and really backfired on them is they created what they called a Dangerous Wild Animal Board, and that consisted of a representative from the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Natural Resources, and the Department of Health and Human Resources. And as you can imagine, people from the Department of Health and Human Resources know nothing about exotic animals. The Department of Agriculture knows about animals, but they don't know about exotic animals. And the DNR, likewise, you know, they know about native reptiles and amphibians, but they don't. So the whole concept was
flawed.
Well, it turned out to be disastrous, really.
Yeah. So what happened after once it got through the legislative rule route?
So what happened was, you know, this dangerous wild animal board originally proposed a 5-page list of dangerous wild animals. The 5-page list was in small font, was single lines, included entire scientific orders, scientific families, scientific genuses. So, for example, one line of the 5 pages listed all turtles. That's, 300-plus species. All salamanders, 800-plus species. All tree frogs, all clawed frogs, all toads, the large constrictor list that we're familiar with, all venomous snakes, and all crocodilians. In fact, one line of about fish included approximately 2,000 species. So there were literally tens of thousands of animals that were listed, including rabbits. I mean, there were so many animals that were your basic pet store animals that were listed that people were in shock when they saw this list.
Excellent.
There was that list was published, and there was a 30-day comment period, and we at the initial phase of that, we worked the governor because he had previously vetoed essentially the same law 2 years before, and so it was kind of illogical that he all of a sudden would sign the same law. So we worked the governor and pointed out the ridiculousness of this list. And about 2 weeks into the 30-day comment period, the Dangerous Wild Animal Board at one of their meetings said, "We're throwing out this list and we're starting all over." And that essentially cut what they produced after that was a list that was about half the length of what they had started with. And that list was what they finally published as their final proposed rule. At that point, the rule had to go to what they call the Legislative Rulemaking Review Committee. That's 6 senators and 6 delegates who, get the first look at the rule. They look at the public comments, and there's an opportunity for the public to come in and present their concerns to this legislative committee. And in fact, I made 2 appearances in Charleston, West Virginia, on behalf of US ARC, which is about 420 miles each way. And the first time I went there, they decided, because the Dangerous Wild Animal Board had not made a list and provided it to the committee of the reasons for listing these animals, they decided that they were going to postpone that hearing. And after having driven 7.5 hours, I wanted to get a word in edgewise, and so I stood up and I told them that I'd driven all the way from Maryland, and that I would like just a couple minutes to mention a few things that I thought would be very helpful, you know, for the Dangerous Wild Animal Board to also address, you know, in the, you know, between that hearing and the next hearing. And they didn't want to hear from me, and they told me that I was out of order, and so I got you know, I got my points in fairly quickly, and then sat down before I was held in contempt of their hearing. And okay, a month later, I was back again. And we, at that hearing, successfully had all, you know, the large constrictor snakes removed. And that was in November of you know, last year. Okay. So at that point, all we had left was crocodilians and venomous snakes on the list. And that's what went through the legislature, and the West Virginia legislative session starts January 14th. So, you know, the session started, and you know, and we were pretty excited because there was four senators who submitted a bill that would have entirely repealed the Dangerous Wild Animal Board. And that's okay, four senators out of 34. So that was pretty significant. And Phil Goss and I, you know, spoke to the senator. He was very excited to get this crazy thing repealed. But unfortunately, that bill, for reasons that, you know, aren't entirely clear, was never brought up in the original committee that it was assigned to. So it basically got killed off before it even got started. And that was pretty disappointing because the West Virginia legislature had flipped from Democratic to Republican. And with the Republicans in charge of all of the committees, you know, we had been, you know, informed that they believed in personal freedoms and liberty, and that this, you know, that this law was, you know, on their target list. But nonetheless, that died off. Okay. And so, meanwhile, the Dangerous Wild Animal Rule that contained the crocodilians and venomous snakes on the Dangerous Wild Animal list was going through the legislature. So, mm-hmm, you know, we had to get in the way of that, the bill that contained that rule. And the way they work it in West Virginia is they wrap up a bunch of rules into one bill. So, you know, so our Dangerous Wild Animal Rule also had rules about pharmacies and all kinds of crazy stuff. Hmm. And so that bill got through the Senate side while we were, you know, trying to support the entire repeal. And on the House side, we got the bill amended to remove crocodilians and venomous snakes last Wednesday. Yes. And then on Friday, it was brought up in the Senate. And after a fairly ugly, you know, debate and back and forth, the senators on a vote of 25-9, you know, confirmed the rule. They concurred in the amendments from the House. And so as of Saturday, you know, we now have, you know, all of the original animals removed from the list except for Komodo dragons, which, you know, you can't own them anyway.
Sure.
Well, that's pretty substantial then.
Yeah, I mean, we're obviously very happy about that. And, and just to kind of contrast that, to what happened in Ohio, where, they have, the issues with, constrictor snakes, with venomous, and with crocodilians. We cleared the table. So that's a fairly significant accomplishment, because once you get to the venomous and the crocodilians and the large constrictors, there's a public perception and a perception amongst the legislators that these are dangerous animals. And so, it is, a real fight as compared to trying to say, well, we don't need salamanders on the list. We don't need tree frogs on the list. That's the easy stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's a nice bolster to your confidence too, to be able to pull that out.
Yeah. So, I actually drafted the amendment that was presented before the House, and I provided our delegate who sponsored the amendment with a 2-page explanation of the reasons why venomous snakes and crocodilians should not be on the dangerous wild animal list. And he literally got on the floor of the House and read what I had written, word for word. So that was kind of interesting, and it tells you that that if you do the work for them, that pays off, and that's been my experience in the past. I mean, I've drafted bills in the past, and I've prepared legislators, I've prepared other people for testimony.
Nice. Sounds like you're the right guy for the job. Sounds like you're the right guy for the job.
Well, so far, so good.
Awesome. So now let's dig into that U.S. Fish and Wildlife listing.
Sure. I think the first thing that is important for people to understand is that there was no obligation on the part of Fish and Wildlife to give us a heads up that they were going to announce their decision on, the 4 remaining species, the green anaconda and the other 2 anacondas, which aren't which are not in the trade, and the reticulated pythons. And so we got wind of the fact that this was going to occur down in Florida, less than 24 hours before it actually was announced. And Phil and I spoke about it, and he scooted down there. And I don't know if you've seen it on the internet, but there's some video of him actually asking the director of Fish and Wildlife, a guy by the name of Dan Ash, questions.
Hmm.
Basically, confronting him with some very hard questions. So anyway, they've listed these animals. It's their case for the berms and the yellow anacondas and the African rocks. It's not a good case, in my opinion, but it's a stronger case than when you start listing green anacondas and reticulated pythons, because the fact is that there's been 2 green anacondas that have been documented as found in South Florida, and 2 reticulated pythons that were anywhere near the Everglades. It's those animals are a completely different issue as compared to the Burmese python, which The Burmese python seems to be on the edge of its range, whereas, reticulated pythons and green anacondas are really probably, not capable of surviving in the Everglades for any significant time. And, not being able to establish themselves, which means, actually being able to breed. So this more recent listing is a lot weaker. And, we've been aware that this could happen at any time, and they obviously don't, move at great speed. But, our plan was that if they listed any of these animals, and by the way, they didn't list the boa constrictor. That was the one snake out of the nine that were originally proposed. It was the only one that they didn't list. Our plan was that if they listed these animals, that we would first, amend the existing complaint against Fish and Wildlife to add any newly listed animals, and we would also file for what they call a preliminary injunction. A preliminary injunction is an extraordinary remedy because you're asking a judge to rule against an opposing party before they've had the opportunity to hear all the evidence, to hear from the experts, to have everything presented from them. And so that's something that, you can get, but it's not something that, that they're throwing around very easily. Just think about it. Suppose, someone could go in court and get a preliminary injunction against you before you have an opportunity to bring in your witnesses and so on and so forth to prove that, whatever the issue is, that they're wrong about it.
Right.
They have a pretty high, what lawyers call, the standards, the requirements for issuing a preliminary injunction. And by the way, what that essentially means is that, they're not going to hear all of the evidence, as a full blown case. What the judge is being asked to do is to enjoin the Fish and Wildlife from enforcing the prohibition on importation and the prohibition on interstate transportation for the newly listed animals before the judges heard all of the arguments.
Okay.
So, anyway, the high standards, I'll go through them, for preliminary injunction is that there has to be a significant threat to the plaintiff if the injunction is not granted. And that threat has to be what they call irreparable harm. And that's a really tough standard to meet because, arguing that, I'm going to lose a lot of money, that doesn't do it. Irreparable harm has to be something that can't be fixed by money. And I'm not going to get into the details of the argument right now because, that'll be revealed when the filing actually occurs. But I am very pleased with, our argument on that. I think it's a very strong argument. And I think that the attorneys for Fish and Wildlife will have a sinking feeling when they, you know, when they hear that argument, they're going to realize that, you know, that, that we've focused right in on that requirement, and that we meet it, you know. And I've been working with, you know, some of the large constrictor people, a lot with Kevin McCurley, to fine-tooth the argument on that. And there's some other requirements that have to be met also. If you show irreparable harm, then the court looks at, well, what's the harm to the other side if the injunction is issued? And, you know, in this particular case, you know, they'd be looking at, you know, well, what's the likelihood that, you know, failing to, you know, have the interstate ban and importation ban in place, you know, what's the likelihood that that would allow invasive populations to, you know, to occur meanwhile?
Yeah.
And then, you know, the third requirement is that, you know, they look at the probability that we, USR, is going to ultimately succeed on the merits of the case. So in other words, if they look at this and say, well, yeah, okay, well, you know, there's irreparable harm here, and it's not that much damage to the other side compared to the damage to you, but if they look and they say, but this is a BS case, you know, you're not going to win on this case, then, then they're going to say that is going to essentially knock you out. And we have an incredibly strong case in a lot of, you know, ways, but there's one that for some reason, as many times as I've mentioned it, people have not really seemed to grasp, and that is a legal argument that we have that Fish and Wildlife has no authority to ban interstate transportation.
Beautiful.
And think about that. Think about that. I mean, you know, if they can't ban interstate transportation, then
what are they doing?
Suppose we lose the importation part. You know, the hugest amount of the damage is to the breeders who can't transport these animals across state lines and are confined, like in Kevin McCurley's case, to the state of New Hampshire. Well, that's impossible. You know, he can't possibly support his, you know, almost 700 reticulated pythons on a few sales within the essentially teeny state of New Hampshire.
Sure.
So, you know, to go back to this interstate issue, you know, what happens is that Fish and Wildlife, they make an announcement. And in the announcement, they have said, both when the, you know, when the Burmese python were listed, and now with the green anaconda and the retics, you know, they just in kind of just in the dialogue, they say, you know, that you are prohibited from engaging in interstate transportation. Well, that's fine and good, but it's not what they say in their general dialogue that counts. What's important is, what does the actual Lacey Act authorize them to do? Mm-hmm. So you have to go back and you have to look at the actual language of the law. And the actual language of the law is clear on saying that they have the authority for listed species to prohibit importation.
Okay.
But the law does not the law does not use the word interstate transportation. That word does not show up in the law. And I think
nice.
That that's probably shocking to most people because everyone assumes that's the case. And this is the reason why back in January of 2012, I was saying, you know, we have to fight this case. It doesn't get any better than this. You know, my background is as a tax lawyer, and so, you know, I work with federal statutes, and Lacey Act is a federal statute. And I looked at this Lacey Act statute, I said, this would never fly. This would never fly, you know, in taxes. What the statute says is that the Fish and Wildlife has the authority to prohibit shipment between the continental United States, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, Guam, and United States territories. That's the language that's in the statute. I may not have them in the right order, but that's the language that's in the statute. The continental United States is a geographic area that includes, you know, the 48, you know, states, you know, that we all think about. And then, of course, Alaska is part of the continent. So what the statute is saying is that you can't ship from the continental United States to Hawaii, to Puerto Rico, to Guam, or, you know, from Guam to Puerto Rico, from Puerto Rico to Hawaii. But the continental United States, there's nothing that says that you can't ship between the continental United States or within the continental United States.
Seems like a slam dunk.
And what happened is that when I started working with U.S. ARC about a year ago, Phil and I made a long list of things that we wanted to accomplish, and one of the things, was okay. You know, we've got this statute, and it really doesn't say that we can't engage in interstate transportation. So where are they getting this from? You know, how do they come to the conclusion that they're entitled to interpret this to mean something that when you read it, it doesn't say that?
Yeah.
And you say, wow, what lawyers do is they look at that, and the argument that is presented is, that when a statute is clear on its face, you read what they call the plain language, and just read the words.
Mm-hmm.
What do they say? If those words are clear, then that's the law, period. If there's some large ambiguity, how sometimes you can read something and it seems to mean it could mean a couple different things.
Sure.
Then what they do is they say, okay, well, let's look at the legislative history. When these laws are enacted, typically you have what they call a House report, and you have a Senate report, and if it goes to a conference committee, you'll have the conference committee report. You'll have, testimony, before the committees. So you say, okay, well, let's go back and look and see what they, see what they said they were doing, when this law was put in place. And, I went back and I found where the Fish and Wildlife had themselves in 1977, when they were proposing a regulation that would have essentially banned most importation of animals into the United States.
Yeah.
They, in that proposed regulation, further explained this language in the statute. And what they said back then was that, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't have it right in front of me, but they said that the prohibition on shipment, and they actually flipped that to transportation at some point, but that's a separate issue. The difference between what shipment is and transportation. But what Fish and Wildlife themselves said was that, the prohibition applied to transportation between any two of the following geographic areas, colon, and then continental United States, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the U.S. territories. So that, they kind of added, added that the continental United States, that was what it meant, that was one geographic area.
Yeah.
And that's the Fish and Wildlife themselves saying that.
We have 2 minutes, Rick.
Okay.
And we're going to get cut off in 2 minutes, so I'm just letting you know.
Okay. Well, let me wrap this up. That was Fish and Wildlife saying that themselves, and those regulations do not go through and get, proposed regulations don't get publicized in the Federal Register until they have been approved at the highest levels of Fish and Wildlife, and then the highest levels of the Department of Interior, which Fish and Wildlife is part of. I'll just add one little bit. We've got additional stuff that backs this up.
Cool. That's great. Well, that boosts my confidence a little bit.
Well, I've been excited about this for a long time. And, we're going to lean heavily on that issue for the preliminary injunction.
Well, Rick, I'm glad you're on the case, and we are getting near the end. Guys, thanks for listening. Rick, maybe we're going to get you back on one day, and when we hear some more after the injunction is processed, and we'll talk then.
Very good. Just remember, any particular judge can rule any particular way, but we have a really strong case on the merits and for the preliminary injunction.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Rick. We'll talk to you soon. Take care, guys. Have a good one.
Well, thank
bye-bye.
You, CK.
Pleasure.